So, changing topics, you'll work with me a little bit here. But the Seder. So, this week, in addition, as Rabbi Wasserman mentioned, to Parshat Tzav, it is Parshat Para, right? Which is probably not Daraita, though there is a potential Shittan Rishonim that it's also Daraita to mention Parshat Para once a year. So, I want to talk a little bit about Parah Aduma, about Chok, some combination of philosophy and Parshanut, but I think it's an important conversation to have, and, you know, like I said, I had to switch topics right now. So,
will you or will you not quote Jacob Miller?
Would you like me to?
I would love it.
Okay, you can quote him, okay? So, fine. So as you probably know, Chazal set up Para Aduma as the paradigmatic, the paradigmatic chok. What is a chok? Okay, let's be very precise. Whoa.
We don't know the reason.
What? Okay, so the Gemara, so the Midrash famously in Kohelet Rabbah says as follows. Guys, okay. So Midrash in Kohelet Rabbah says that the following, right? Amarti echkama v'hi rechokami many. The Pasuk in Goelit says, I said I was smart, but it is far from me. And Chazal comments on this, that Shlomo understood all mitzvot, with the exception of Parah Aduma. And what is so puzzling about Parah Aduma? What is the quality of the Parah Aduma that is so puzzling? It's mitaret atmeim and mitameet tahorim. Correct. It is the ashes of the Parah Aduma make people tahor. But anyone who's involved in the process is tamei. Now, some people assume based on this that Parah Aduma is in its entirety a chok. Entirety in a law that, please don't explode that on me, is not understandable. And some assume that it's only the element, this particular element, that is mitame eta tahorim, it's mitame darman tahorim et tamayim, that is a chok. But I want to talk a little bit about chok, why the category exists, what the category even means, because I think it's important. I don't think we've had this conversation this year. So first of all, what is a chok? What is a chok? Right? What is a chok? Okay. So one possibility is Evan notes is it's a law for which to a law whose reason we don't know. What's the other possibility? A law that has no reason. Okay? So this divides amongst Rishonim, but name me a Rishon who thinks that a chok is a law that has no reason.
Rashi,
very good. Right? This is why I tell you you're not a beginner. Good God. Come on. Right? Rashi. Rashi says, if you look in the Sugya in Yoma, for example, Chok, mashma she'eno el gzeirat melech. It implies that it is merely a decree of the king. No more, no less. Okay? It has no reason.
Not even.
Who, not surprisingly, takes this and goes mildly nuts? Wow! How'd you guess? Very good. Rambam. No, they were right. The Rambam. No, I don't think Tosafot bothers on this one. But the Rambam says in the Morning of Uchim, in Chelek Gimel, he says, yeah, I have one in front of me. So first he starts by insulting people who think that no mitzvot have reasons, right? He says, there is a group of human beings who consider it a grievous thing that causes should be given for any law. What would please them most is that the intellect would not find a meaning for the commandments and prohibition. What compels them to feel thus is a sickness that they find in their souls, a sickness to which they are unable to give utterance, and of which they cannot furnish a satisfactory account. For they think that if those laws were useful in this existence and had been given to us for this or that reason, it would be as if they derived from the reflection and understanding of some intelligent being. If, however, there is a thing for which the intellect could not find any meaning at all that does not lead to something useful, it indubitably derives from God, for the collection of man would not lead to such a thing. Okay? It is as if, according to these people, of weak intellects, man were more perfect than his maker. For man speaks and acts in manner that leads to some intended end, whereas the deity does not act thus, but commands us to do things that are not useful to us, and forbids us to do things that are not harmful to us. But he is far exalted above this. The contrary is the case. The whole purpose consisting in what is useful for us, as we explain in the base of this dictum, for our good always, Right? Thus, it states explicitly that even all the chukim will show to all the nations that they've been given with wisdom and understanding, right? He gets this in the pasuk of Rak, Am Chachon Venavon Agoyagada Ulaze, including on chukim. So therefore, what does he think a chok is?
A law whose reason is less
obvious. A law whose reading either is less obvious or we don't know. Okay? Yacholiot. It could be that we don't know or we can't know. Okay? Yes. Okay. Ezra. Okay, so we should be precise. The Rambam does not think there is any mitzvah in its totality that has no reason. The Rambam has a shita that the pratim, or the Rambam has this shita, which is very reasonable, I think, which is that even if you think that mitzvot in general all have reasons, the details of mitzvot might not have reasons, and in fact, you would be overthinking it, because he says, look, the Torah, it makes sense to limit, for example, our appetitive desires, and therefore say, if you want to eat meat, you have to eat it by killing in a certain way. But if you say you kill it from the front, then you'd ask, why not the back? If God had said do it from the back, you'd say, why not the front? If God had said, stab it, you'd say, why not cut off its head, right? So the Rambam says, right? You don't look for the pratim, right? It makes sense to limit things that we eat. But not every pratim. Yes, the Rambam does think that details are, arbitrary is the wrong word, right? Because if I put it this way, if I said it makes sense that there should be such a thing as a traffic light, right? Because people are coming from different directions, you have to stop them, right? So there's a mishpat on the whole thing. But then if you started overthinking it and said, well, why did you choose green to be the one that means go? And why is yellow slow down? Why is red stop? And why in Israel is it more of an orangey yellow, right? Like at some point you're like, if I had done it magenta, you would have asked why this shade of, right? I mean, like, right? At some point, it's rational for not every detail to be overthought. In fact, it's irrational when you start, right? But the Rambam doesn't think that any category of mitzvah can have no reason, where Rashi disagrees, right? So first point I want to make is, okay, let's analyze that machloket philosophically. Let's start with the Rambam. What is the logic of the Rambam? The Rambam is quite clear. Why does the Rambam think that chok can't mean a law that has no reason? No, that's not what it's true, but that's not what he's arguing. It's a stronger point, Ezra.
Well, it seems like he's saying that implies that God acts.
Very good. Is that he can't believe that God is arbitrary, right? This is the same reason why the Rambam, for example, thinks that nature, right? He thinks that miracles should be minimized, right? And you should, as much as possible, understand the world to follow nature, and that even miracles, he thinks, were programmed in from creation. For the very simple reason, if I want to oversimplify it, the way Rai Karmi once said it, is that the Rambam, the primary feature that he focuses on when he's understanding God is God's wisdom. Whereas, let's say the Ramban, at least as he presents it in Bo, admittedly it's intentional what he says in Eov, so I'm not going to get into a deal on the Ramban, but the Ramban, as he says it in Eov, in Bo, is a pure occasionalist, that nature doesn't really exist, and that anyone who thinks that there is nature, ain lo chelik b'torah et Moshe Rabbeinu, it has no portion in Moshe's Torah. In fact, what it is what looks like nature is really God happened to act repetitively. We mentioned this earlier today. It happens to act consistently every time, but there really is no nature. But what drives the Ramban? A belief that what's the defining feature of God is his power rather than wisdom. And the Rambam, ki'ilu, right, from the Ramban's perspective, limits the Rambam's power, because he's saying, no, you have to, right? What you do has to make sense. Whereas some level, and I hate to use this word, but at some level it's true. Capriciousness is an expression of power. Right. So, for example, I to tie you into Purim for a moment. Right. Chazal say that that Haman was Mimuchan. Why do Chazal say Haman was Mimuchan? What drives them to say that? Because how else did someone, Pitom, go? He's not even mentioned in the seven officers of Achashverosh. Pitom is the second in command, and everything goes by him. But Yoram Chazoni has an interesting suggestion, counter Chazal, and he says, no, that's exactly the point. Because Achashverosh's power was threatened in the previous chapter. What's the best way to make it clear that you have absolute power? Is to arbitrarily, right? Is to do something arbitrary that everyone now has to listen to. If you had taken someone who had climbed the political ranks, so it's not arbitrary. The guy already had political power, I give him a promotion. But if you just say, I'm taking a guy off the street, you are now saying, man, everyone will bow to you or they die, right? And now everyone has to listen, right? At some level, capriciousness is a sign of power, of absolute, unmitigated power. So at some level, the Rambam, who can ikvi, he's consistent about the fact that the feature for him that's most important by God is that he's planned and wise, the ultimate wisdom. How could it be he commands something that has no reason? That we don't understand it. We're limited. That's possible. But that it shouldn't have a reason. Right? On the other hand, Rashi, right? Rashi doesn't care, right? Think about it. Rashi says, and Rashi is somewhat ikvi about this also, right? Rashi says, no, it's Gzeret Melech. It's a decree. What does Rashi think the point of a chok is, probably? That what qualities it's supposed to engender? Obedience. And we know Rashi famously in Sanhedrin Ayin Vav says that, right, the Gemara says that it's a terrible thing, right? Lo yoveh Hashem shloach lo, if someone returns a lost object to a non-Jew. Okay, that's what the Gemara says. Rashi says, why? Because if you return an object to a lost Jew, what does that show? That you're returning lost objects because, like, you're a good person. Because, like, you're doing it for a Jew and doing it for a non-Jew. And that's terrible. You shouldn't do mitzvah because you're a good person. You're a Jew because God said so. And therefore, do it. When God said do it, do it. When God said don't do it, don't you dare. Because if you do it, that shows you're doing it because you feel like this is right. I don't care what you feel, right? You do what God says and so.
Well, isn't that the reason then, in a sense?
Well, yes, but there is no specific reason. But the point is that it's fundamentally, in its content, arbitrary. The motivation is obedience. Right? And obedience is right? Obedience isn't as well expressed if something makes sense. Right? If I tell you, you know, don't have poison, and you listen to me, that doesn't per se show obedience to me. It shows you don't want to die. Yeah. Right? But if I tell you for the next 36 hours, I want you to only jump on your left foot no matter what, right? And you listen, right, that shows that you're obedient. I don't suggest. What? No, Rashi's not saying, no. We should be, well, so that's the interesting thing, is that Rashi isn't saying all mitzvot, he's saying chukim or that, but yet by Hashavat Aveda, which you would not have said is a chok, he still says something which is sort of in tandem with that. So that's why I'm saying Rashi is actually somewhat consistent, because he's saying even if it's which are chukim, which are mishpatim, you should keep them because God said so. Right, there may be a rationale, but at some level, you actively have to show that's not why you're doing it. Right? Yeah.
10 seconds for an important announcement regarding the cholent.
Very good.
The cholent was off, was unplugged, and not cooking overnight, and started cooking this morning. It was still very cold when I touched it. With that being said, raise your hand if you want to eat cholent. It should still be safe.
Okay.
It should be entirely cooked.
Yeah. Now, look, there are middle positions, like the Radak, who says that a chok is something that a chacham will understand, right? But maybe the average person won't understand. Right, which again, that's a plausible, you know, plausible model. Sure, right? We can talk about that. Okay, but like I said, what I want to do tonight, we won't cover everything, but I want to talk about Chok. Okay, so
just to be clear, we're talking about Chok used. How the
correct. Correct. I'm talking about chok. I'm talking about chok as the rabbanon understand it. Israel Isaac is completely correct that chok in the Torah more precisely probably just means an order.
Right.
Is that what you wanted? You wanted that milgram point? Yes. So Israel Isaac is correct that in In rabbinic language, chok means this. He's right that in Torah it's not clear that chok means that. Chok just might mean an order, right? An order. That's true. I'm not getting to a biblical discussion of how Chazal do it. I want to analyze a little bit the theology of Chazal. So the first point is, which I think is very important, is this machloket, we'll call it the machloket Rambam Rashi, is does it make sense that mitzvot should have no reason whatsoever, or just ones that either we can't access, or even according to Radak, that a non-chacham can't access, which is even more limited, right? Something that, it's just like not obvious. Mushpadim are things that rules are, the reasons are obvious. Chukim are nisht obvious. But a chacham could get to it. Right, and according to the Rambam, the reason there can't be a chok which has no reason is because, for him, the fundamental driver is that God can't be arbitrary. For Rashi, at some level, we've seen that he does have a nima, that obedience is independently important. Okay? Yeah.
The Rav quoted the Rambam condemning those who say, fiercely condemning those who say that God does arbitrary things, or he commands arbitrarily.
Yeah.
Are there... Who's he talking to? Are there Rishonim who say that the commandments are...
Well, Rashi.
As a general statement, that the commandments in general are...
Well, think about it. Rashi says this is what a chok is, but Rashi, on a Shevet Aveda, which is a mishpat, says you shouldn't do it because you think it's the right thing to do, right? I mean, there are definitely people who are closer to that. Whether he has someone in mind, a chacham, doesn't sound like that, right? I don't know if he means a chacham. I don't know. Okay. Now... I want to push this farther, though. Okay? So there is a midrashic tradition that appears in different ways throughout, in many different places in Chazal. Okay? But I'll read you the version that's in Psikta de Rav Kahana. Okay? But there are versions of it in many, many midrashim. Because this highlights one of the problems of chok. So the Gemara tells a story. Goy echad sha'alid Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. There was a non-Jew that approached Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and asked him to follow. Amar lei, ilein milaya da'atun avden niren kamo kshafim. These things that you do seem like magic. Why this Torah, you rationalists? Bunch of witchcraft. Why? Mivian para, vishochdenota, visorfinota, vikochinota, vinotlin et afara, the echad mikem mitame lemet, umazan lov shtaim shal shtivim omrim lo taharata. You take a cow, you shecht it, you slaughter it, you burn it, you crush it up, you take its ashes, you mix it into water, you sprinkle it 2-3 times. Oh, the guy's star. Right? So Rabbi Yochanan says to him, "Amar lo, lo nichnesa ruach tazazit ba'oto ha'ish b'yamav." He said, "Did you ever have a spirit, an evil spirit, possess you?" Amar lo lav. He said, "No, I've never been possessed." Amar lo v'lo ri'ita achar shenel ruach tazazit. Have you ever seen someone else possessed? Amar lo hein. He said, "Of course I have." Amar lo matem osim. And he says, "And what do you do?" Amar lo, mivin ikrin, you bring roots, ashen tachtov, and you smoke them underneath. Umar beats them, might make some water, v'hibarachat, and it runs away, the evil spirit runs away. Amar lo, v'lo yishmichu aznecha masha picha midaver. Don't you hear what you're saying? Kacha ruach azeh ruach tumahi. So too, this is an evil spirit. It's an impure spirit. Dichtiv gamen nevi emin ruach tumah. V'kevin sheyatza. Now, so that, and the guy says, "Oh, good point," and he leaves. He leaves, and his talmidim turn to Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai. The chayven sheyatzah amar lo talmidav, Rabbi, lazed dechita bekane. This guy you knocked away with a reed. Lanu ma tameshiv. Come on, that's not the real reason. What are you telling us? This nourish guy. Amar lahem chayechem. He says, "I swear, lo hamet metame. The dead doesn't create toma. V'lo amayim metarin. And water doesn't make you tahor. Elag zerato shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's God's. Omar HaKadosh Baruch, when God said, Chuka chakakti, I decreed a decree, zera gazarti, however you want to, the distinction between those, ve'ein atar rashay la'avor al gzerati, zot chukat atarah. You can't violate it, this is the law. Now, I want to talk about this midrash, because it's a very important midrash. Okay, what is going on in this midrash? Let's pick it apart carefully. Okay? What is going on? Now, actually, no, before I read that, before we analyze it, I want you to give one parallel source, okay? And maybe let's read them together, okay? Here's a different version of a similar type of discussion, which talks about Chukim u'Mishpatim. This is the version in Yoma Samach Zayin, okay? Tana Rabbanan, et mishpatai ta'asu, my laws you shall keep, dvarim she'ilmalei nichtivu, things that had they not been written, din hu she'yichtivu. It would make sense logically that they should have been written. The Elohim, right? So that's a mishpat. Things that had it not been written, they should have been written. Which again, according to the Rambam, means that you would have known that should be written. According to Rashi, is they have a reason. What are they? Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayot. Now, this, by the way, is a whole shiur in and of itself. Whether Gilui Arayot is in fact a chok, because some sources in Chazal assume it's a chok, some assume it's a mishpat. Here it assumes it's a mishpat, which is very interesting. Right? Because if you ever try to rationalize all the Arayot, you will get stuck. Yeah. It's also Machok Rishonim. Ken Velo. V'gilui Arayot, Ushvicha Domin, murder, V'gezel Brikat Hashem. Okay? Theft and blasphemy. V'et Chukotai Tishmoru, you should keep my Chukim. Dvarim Sha Satan, V'umot Ha'olam Mishivin Alem. These are things that the Satan and the nation of the world respond to. V'eluhein, Achilat Chazir, eating meat, eating pig. Ulevishat Shatnez, Vechalitzat Yevama, Vitarat Mitzora, Usira Mishtaleach. Interesting, it doesn't quote Paradimo, which is very interesting. Vishemat Omer Masetohim, and maybe you'll say they're worthless, they're vanity. Talmud Lomar Ani Hashem. It says, I am God. Ani Hashem Chekaktiv, Ein Lecharishut Laher Bahed. Now, both of these sources have a common denominator, which is they assume that when there's a chok, what's going to happen? There's an imagined, or in the case of the Psikta, an actual criticism. Meaning we are actually called upon to defend the Torah. Right? Yes? So now let's analyze it, okay? First of all, why is it important that the Gemara and the Midrash assume that there will be a criticism? Why is that important? Why is it important for the Gemara, for the Midrash, to voice the notion that there will be criticism of the mitzvah? Okay, so one possibility is they are, and there's a power to this, which is they are rejecting, they know what you're going to think, and they say it before you do, right? Which is, right, there's something to this, right? Which is, if I know that something doesn't make sense and I own it, so now you know I'm not stupid, right? You know that I'm aware of the same thing. I thought what you did, and I have a response, right? A lot of people do that, right? This is a good polemic, which is, I know what they're going to say, right? Which means, be ready. Okay, so at some level, I think that's it. But there's more. Right? And if you go back to the Rambam, I think there's more, which is, the Rambam says that this isn't just a question. The fundamental definition of the mitzvot is people are going to say, Rak am chacham v'navona goya gadol hazeh. The Torah is supposed to make sense. They're supposed to be wise. They're supposed to be expression of God's wisdom. So it's perception is actually important because God's wisdom is supposed to be evident through the mitzvot. When they're not, that actually calls into question the mitzvah. It's at some level undermining the purpose. Okay? Yeah.
Understood every mitzvah wouldn't be that wise then.
So I think you're actually right. I think that for the Rambam and the Rambam and the Radak, I think you're right, which is according to Rashi, some mitzvot have no reason. According to the Rambam and the Radak, there's some mitzvot that either are inaccessible to humans or inaccessible to non-brilliant humans. Right? That's a way of saying, listen, everything has a reason, but God is much smarter than you, so you might not understand it. Right. So I think you're right that you want to balance. On the one hand, you want to say that everything God does makes sense. On the other hand, you want to say that God's wisdom is deeper than yours. The way you do that is you say everything has a reason, but not everything is either accessible at all or easily accessible. Right. Now, obviously, if you want to go the Radak's direction, not everything's easily accessible, but it is accessible. You would just say, if you don't understand it, it's enough to say God commanded it and there is a reason. Maybe you'll understand it. But if not, right, if 600 mitzvot make sense, right, then you should have enough trust that the ones you don't understand, like Zera Yimil Vanite. So when the Gemara says the rationale is Zera, it doesn't actually mean Zera. It just means, it's not that that's the only justifying reason, which is how Rashi takes it. Right? It's just that that should be enough for you. If you don't understand it, trust God, and maybe one day you'll understand it. But in the meantime, you have enough faith because of the other 600 mitzvah that makes sense to you. Right? The ones you don't understand also have a deep logic.
Going on Ben Zakkai's statements, their simple meaning is not that. Their simple meaning is the following. That there is no...
Which statement? Wait. I want you to be careful. Now let's go to the psikta, because the psikta is a very careful one. The psikta... We have to be careful. What happens? He's asked about this. What does he say first?
His first idea is that impurity and purity...
His first reason. First reason.
Not the Zera?
No. His first reason. To the... the non-Jew.
What you do is just as silly.
No. Punkt fuck
here. No. It's like what you do is reasonable.
Correct. Is that you find that to be reasonable... Even though you don't understand it per se, right? So this makes sense also. And then the Talmidim come and they say that's not a good reason. Now this is an amazing scene because what happens? He says to them, "Well, you do things that you can't understand, and that makes sense to you." And he's like, "Oh yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you know, medicine is sort of magic-y. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Great, thank you." His Talmidim say, "Oh, come on, that doesn't work." And he says to them, "I got a better svara for you. God said so."
Good
start. What? What is going on? So this midrash and comment, I think, is super important, right? Because at first glance, it makes no sense. To understand what it's trying to say, you really got to think. You got to think. So what is it saying? So
I think it's not simply that God said so, and you can.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
I think what he's saying is that purity and impurity and things of that nature do not exist in reality. They do not exist as observable phenomena. They're merely designations by
okay,
God.
So Israel Isaac says that maybe it's specifically Tumah and Tarah, yeah. Right, is that, listen, Tumah isn't real, it's a halacha category. And therefore, it doesn't make sense to you. What do you mean doesn't make sense to you, right? I don't understand. If Tumah was a reality and I had to exercise it, right? So fine, you have to prove that it works. But if God says, treat X as such, and he says, if you want to remove the obligation to treat X as such, then do Y. So it doesn't not make sense. It doesn't make sense per se, but it doesn't not make sense, right? It's a category which is decreed by God.
And that would then be like a polemic against people that hold there being like a metaphysical reality.
Which would obviously be claim that Tumah and Tarah are not real, right. Correct? Yeah. Right, in a metaphysical sense, they're just halachic statuses, right? Right, yes. Now, but I want to push it farther, okay? There's a few, I think, very important things that emerge from this. Okay, so one is that to fully understand this, and this I heard many years ago from Christine Hayes, and this is the central thesis of her book, What's Divine About Divine Law? And if I boil down her thesis in one, you know, sort of one, in sound bite, Christine Hayes, as we've talked about, is one of the most fascinating human beings in the world. She's, as you can guess, not Jewish. Christine is not, you know, usually Vikarei Shema B'Yisrael Christine. That doesn't usually happen. She was, for many years, the head of Jewish studies at Yale. That she now is retired.
What?
Yes, she's retired last year. She is, you missed her. She's great. She is. She was editor of Dine Yisrael. She's very fun. I took a seminar with her at some point with years ago during the summer, and it was a lot of fun. We asked her once how she got into this, and I mean she's the firmest person in the world. It's so much fun. She's like, look, all I know is that the first thing I want to do when I get up in the morning and the last thing I want to do at night is engage with what these rabbis had to say. And then we're like, well, how did you get into this? So she said, someone asked her why she didn't convert, and she said something along the lines of, it would create a shalom bias problem, right? what? I don't know. And then she said, well, we actually actually got into it. She said, well, she took Tversky, Professor Tversky at Harvard, right, who lived a double life. You know, he was both Isidore Tversky, the head of Jewish studies at Harvard, and Rav Yitzchak Tversky, the Tolna Rebbe, the son-in-law of the Rav, right? Two very different personalities. But he was the head of the Jewish synagogue, famously, yeah. So so she said that he studied with him, and then she told him he wanted to see a PhD, and he said to her, if you knew what you were getting yourself into, you would never do it. So it's a good thing you don't know what you're getting yourself into, which she said she took as a haskama, you know. It was also fun because someone asked her, but how do you do this? Don't you know that Chazal say that you're not allowed to learn? But she says, yes, but Rabbi Meir Paskin's not that way, which is also true. Not in those words. She said Rabbi Meir says that a non-Jew who studies Talmud, that studies the Torah, is like the high priest. But Rabbi Meir doesn't Paskin that way. At which point I was in a conundrum, which is a non-Jew bound by the Klalei Hara'ah of Chazal, or can she say Kimli Kari Meir? I don't know. I mean, this is beyond like the meta Klalei. Like, I like Klalei Psak, but this is where my brain breaks. I don't know anymore. It's like your shot.
What have you thought about
it? But no, I have no idea. I don't even know where you would look. Where are you going to look? What are you going to do? What? Machlokes Sugya. Sanhedrin Nun Chet Nun Ted versus Chagiga Yud Gimel. Whether it's a problem of Gzela or it's a problem of Mesira of Mesira from a Jew to a non-Jew. Okay, anyways.
You can ask for
Shachter. Okay. So you can email Hassan. You email Rav Shai and Rav Shai will ask him. Okay. Anyways.
I have
Rav Shai. Yeah, that's the easiest way. Whenever I have a Shaila for Rav Shachter, that's how I've done it. Okay. Anyways. But she, if you want to summarize her thesis and what's divine about divine law, she summarizes it very simply. She says, the Greeks, okay, in Greek philosophy, there was an important binary. The binary was as follows. Natural law versus conventional law. Okay, what is natural law versus conventional law? So the Greeks thought that natural law, morality being part of natural law, what is natural law? So they equated natural law with divine law. Okay, that which is natural is divine, but the key for them, and the key for the Greeks, let me finish my sentence. The key for the Greeks was that anything that is natural law and therefore divine law must be a law that need not be legislated, is self-evident to the rational mind. And that's what makes something natural, is that it need not be legislated. It can be discovered, it's inherent in nature, and therefore it can be discovered through rational investigation of the world, of your mind, whatever, without a need to legislate. No, you cannot. It need not be legislated, and if it is legislated, that weakens it, because that shows that it needs to be legislated. Okay? Then there is conventional law. Okay? What is conventional law? Law that doesn't intrinsically have a reason and therefore must be legislated. And that is the binary. Okay? No. It's simply legislated. That's what it is. Not social contract. It's legislated. It doesn't matter how it's legislated. You don't need to agree to it. It's just that it's legislated.
What's the cause of it?
What?
What's the cause of it?
The fact that it's legislated.
Remedying, what's the cause of the legislation?
Doesn't matter. That's the whole point.
Whim.
Whim.
The king was
dying. Right. Whim.
On a whim.
However. Right, she points out that Chazal consistently walk away from this binary. Because they say, very importantly, what makes something divine? What makes something divine law?
No. No, that it's rational.
No. That God commanded it. Right? No. It may have a reason, but that's not the point. Right? Meaning, but think about it. The very definition of Torah and mitzvot, really mitzvot more precisely, is that they are tzivuyim. Odd to the point where we say that God al mitzvah v'yosef misha mitzvah v'yosef, that we paskin, it's greater to be commanded than not be commanded, which means that what makes something divine law is that it is commanded by the divine being, by God. That is a rejection of the binary. Now, it may be the case. That they also have reasons, of which, but no, according to Rashi, not all of them have reasons, and yet they're still divine. And even according to the Rambam, not all of them are accessible, my man. Right, which means that the Greek conviction that in order for them to be divine, it must be accessible by the human mind, Chazal are walking away from that binary. how strongly they're walking away from the binary. The Radak might not think they're walking away from the binary entirely, right? No, it might not, right? But if you think about it, right, think about what they're one thing about what Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai is doing. He is, at least in the limited context of Tumah and Tahara, at least. And in the Gemara and Yoma, it's farther than that. Is actively walking away from it. Is saying something is divine law because God said so. It's divine law because it's law that comes from the divine. Right? Does it have a reason? Does it not have a reason? Can you access the reason? Is it that? Yes, no. That may depend on whether it's a chok, whether it's a mishpat. But that's not what makes it divine. Right? That what makes it divine is not that it's natural and can be investigated. It's that God said so. Now, even if you think chukim have a reason, and even if you don't like the Radak, they have a reason that could be accessed, but maybe it's very difficult, still, right, that still seems to, at least partially, if not entirely, walk away from this distinction. It brings back the notion of command as central to Jewish thought, right? So the notion of chok and the way they present chok highlights the fact that central to the notion of mitzvot is the idea of tzivui. Because again, remember, the Greeks actively hate tzivui. If you have to command it, it isn't divine. Where for Chazal, what makes something divine is that God said so. It may also have a reason, but again, to highlight it, that's not what makes it divine. Right? That's not what makes it divine.
Doesn't it get into the question of if the
not necessarily. No, not necessarily. Because remember, the Euthyphro question, right? Right. Meaning, the Euthyphro question, lav dafka, right? Lav dafka. Now, look, it happens to be that I don't think the Euthyphro question is. I also reject the binary of the Euthyphro question.
Okay, fine.
Right?
In terms of applying it to mitzvos, if you would think that the value of mitzvahs would only come from the fact they are mitzvah.
I didn't say that. No, I didn't say that. I said that what makes them divine.
What does that mean?
I said what makes them divine law is that they were commanded by God. That doesn't, right? That's a different question. It's slightly different than the Euthyphro. Right? The Euthyphro question is, why did God command it? This is the question of what makes something divine. Right? And the answer is that God commanded it. You're right. You then could connect to the Euthyphro question. Yeah. But again, I would argue that this was argued at length in Robert Merrihew Adams' impossible book, but a brilliant book, but impossible. And you can borrow it from Ray Ginsberg, but we both agree that it's basically the hardest book we've ever read in our lives. It is brutal. Or you can look at a similar short version, one-page version, Heschel, which makes a similar argument, not nearly as rigorous, which is that the Euthyphro question is a false binary because, right, which is, does God command it because it's right, or is it right because God commanded it, where they both say versions of no. What makes something right, the fundamental value, is that you are imitating God. Right? God is goodness and rationality, right? Right? He is embodied wisdom. And therefore, the goal in life is to mimic him. He doesn't command it because there's like some external goodness to him, right? What you are doing is trying to be godly, right? And therefore, God commands you. Essentially, it's essentially taking v'halachta v'drachav as the key to all mitzvah, that you're supposed to be like God. And therefore, those values that ki'ilu, as we understand them, right, express God's manifestation in the world, we're supposed to mimic. God commands it because he is, or his expression in the world is the instantiation of said values, right? So there's, it's not, right, which is sort of a third way out. But that's a, right, okay?
What do you mean,
right?
Divine.
What do you think?
Like, are you just defining divine as what God?
Yes. Says? For Chazal, yes. For the Greeks, no.
But I'm saying you're defining it. But like,
correct. But that's exactly the point. That Chazal say it's very simple. What makes something divine is God said so.
Meaning, if the Greeks saw the Torah and recognized, like, they saw God commanded, then, like, okay. God.
They would see that as a weakness, because if it needs to be commanded, right, then it's conventional, right? Because that was the definition. Law that must be commanded. Chazal walk away from this, right? Chazal say, and now, this is important. Right, because again, this is important for a lot of reasons. First of all, it's important, yes, because it rejects the Greek, but it also highlights that the definition of mitzvah is tzivui. That even if it is rational, part of why you do the mitzvah is because you're in relationship with the mitzvah, and therefore the command is important. The fact that it was legislated is important. Where for the Greeks that undermines the value, for Chazal that's what makes it a mitzvah. That God was mitzvah. Remember, ad kedei kach, that they say if someone else, it's not just that Chazal say there's less value to something that God didn't command. They say there's less value to something that you know makes sense because God commanded it, but you're not chayev, right? I just want you to, before you raise your hands, I want you to think about that for 2 seconds. The fact that Chazal say that even when something, not just you think it makes sense, but God said it makes sense, even there, it is more valuable to do it if you were mitzuveh. Right? That means even if God gave his stamp of approval to the rationality, it is a formal mitzvah. It's still more important to be a mitzuveh. Right? That's a very radical claim because that highlights the centrality of legislation per se, of command per se. What? So is it obedience or is it, no, he wants there to be a relationship of mitzaveh and mitzuveh. Now, is that the same as obedience? I'm not sure, right? I'm not sure, right? Meaning it's not obedience qua obedience, right? Meaning, put it this way. If I tell Moro don't have poison, right? And he, even if he does it 2% because I told him, right? Or more, or let's say he recognizes that I care about him because I went on the raid to tell him not to do it, right? It's not arbitrary obedience. Right, even though that makes perfect sense, its context has changed. He realized I care about him. Right, there's a more to it. Right, okay, Moro, Ezra, and Ariel, and Moshe. Yeah,
clearly very obvious, you know, rational explanations that people would do anyway. I think maybe you could modify what you were saying and say the specific like principles aren't necessary. Like that. There isn't as much value in the fact that you're mitzuvah on the things that you would rationally come to do anyway, but maybe you could say that on like specific details of how the law is set up, like a chiddush, that would be, that's like more...
Right, okay, so again, that's coming back to Ezra's point from the Rambam before, which is, okay, we have to distinguish between, you might want to distinguish between the klalim and the pratim, you're right, I'm not, this is not a...
I'm saying like in terms of like...
I understand.
Like certain genes, let's say, in... Or Aegis, let's say.
Good. So I come back to that. I'll come back to that in a minute. Like, take questions, I'll come back to it. Okay, Ezra, this is an order of the hands I saw. Ezra, Ariel, Moshe, yeah. Okay, so Ezra's making a version of the Radach argument, a rear view of Rasajagon's argument, which is that, right? So Ezra's arguing, look, Rav Sajagon, let's say, says, really, every mitzvah you could access. It's just it would take you a trillion years, right? But you need to live life within a 70 or, you know, whatever, Shivim Shana, right? You couldn't do it. So God commands it to shortcut it. Now, rationally, that's possible. I find it hard in this source, right? Because what is he saying? I gave him a reason, and even that reason, which is Narish, right? You shouldn't need. It's Gzeirahim Yelfanai, right? Right, meaning it seems to be highlighting that it's not just because then he could have said, "Listen, it makes sense," but
it could be that's his way of saying it makes sense.
I don't know. I'm not sure. He doesn't say that. He says it is Xavier. You shouldn't need an explanation. Right, that's what it sounds like. I understand. Rav Sajagon could look at it. Well, either he could look at it and say that's what he means, or he could say Chukim are the exception because there has to be some value to obedience. Okay, you could be. Yeah, Ariel Moshe.
Status.
Chazal is a very broad thing, but okay, presumably different people in Chazal would say different things, but yes.
Okay. Well, yeah. From what you were saying.
Yeah.
Let's say how they look at it in terms of what we have to do.
So again, there are clearly categories that are beyond Sivui, that are still normative in the sense that you should do them, right? The Rambam says in Perek Aleph Mishnah Yud Zayin, or Tet Zayin, depending on the count, in Avot, but in most counts Yud Zayin, that there aren't three categories in life, there are five, right? There's Chiyuv, Isser, right? And then Rishut, right? So forbidden, obligated, totally neutral. And then there's Mishubach and Miguna, right? Which is praiseworthy, but not obligatory, and disgusting, but not formally forbidden, right? So there is right? And the Ramban famously says that in addition to the mitzvot, there's Kiddushim Tiyu, Asitir Yashratav, and Shabbaton, three mitzvot that all legislate the spirit of the law, right? There are things, and the Gemara says, and this is Nifzak Lahalacha, Locharva Yushalayim, Elishadanu Din Tara. Right, that Yerushalayim was destroyed because everyone stuck to the law. Obviously, you're supposed to go beyond it. In all those categories, you're right. There are categories in the halacha that are specifically not legislated. Then you got to figure out how does that work with their emphasis on tzivui, right? With the fact that they don't want everything to be right, because there really is a complexity there. On the one hand, you want there to be a tzivui. On the other hand, you want people to voluntarily identify with the spirit of what God is doing and recognize its wisdom and choose it, right? So but those categories are not purely neutral, right? They're just not legislated. But it could be the fact that there exist categories that are actively not legislated is highlighting that second element. Okay, Moshe, yeah.
From when you mentioned the value in
doing... Okay, think about your question first. Come on. Say it. I don't want you to think as you're going. I can't... Take 2 seconds, formulate the question, then go. Yes. Yes, but that's cheating. Meaning, you can say, at some level, meaning you're right, but I don't think that totally absolves it. Meaning, you'll say, listen, is it rational? God is the greatest being, the perfect being, and therefore obedience to him is good, and that's rational. So therefore, isn't it rational for certain things to be irrational? Well, yes, but you understand that second-order rationality, not first-order rationality, right? Meaning, this act is not intrinsically rational. It's rational because it's rational to sometimes be irrational in service of obedience to God. That's second-order, right? It's irrational, okay, right? It's rational to sometimes be to follow God even if it's irrational, not anti-rational, but irrational, right? What? So, meaning it's a second order. It's saying it's not that it's intrinsically rational. It's that it's rational to sometimes be obedient to an irrational command. That's second order rationality. Just not rational. It's not, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't necessarily not make sense. I mean, it's not anti-rational. It just, I don't know, or it has, I have no reason to believe it has a particular reason beyond you should do this. Right. Meaning it's rational because it makes sense to be obedient to God. But again, that's second order rationality. I think it's a good question, but I think there still is a distinction between first and second order, right? Where it's rational to be part of the system rather than this action is rational to be part of the system. Those are different, right? Those are different.
You could ask the question why, if God's goal is obedience and obedience only, then why did God command that as opposed to that?
No, no,
that's
not me.
You could ask.
No.
Well, I mean, yes, that's part of the problem with...
My point.
Yeah.
That's my point.
Okay.
It doesn't matter, but clearly he did command something in particular.
He had to pick something. That's not a good question.
Well, yeah, but why did he pick it?
It doesn't matter.
If you're saying it's disobedience, it doesn't matter.
No, but he still has to make a choice.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, but again, but it's still
why did he make a choice? Why did he make that choice?
He recognizes that there's no difference when he chooses it, and therefore he's afraid of it. Just like the number, God could have to pick six or seven counts.
Yeah, okay. But there are a few other points. There are a few other points I want to make. Okay, you could talk about Chukim Mishpatim forever, but there are a few other points I want to make sure to get in before the road closes. Okay, otherwise I could go on forever. But another point is, so I was thinking about this source recently because Ilana Steinhain started a podcast a few weeks ago. Ilana Steinhain. She's done different things. She was, whatever, one of, like, the early graduates of GPAT. She has a PhD in Talmud, from NYU that she did on loopholes. Very interesting person. She started a podcast, and she has one, and this was obvious asking me, called On This Text. It's basically every week she goes through a text with some chavrusa, sometimes with Christine Hayes, sometimes with Liora Betnitsky, whatever, different interesting people, on this. And she pointed to, I had never heard of this term, but code switching.
Yeah.
Right? Now, what's code switching? Code switching is basically where I talk about certain things in certain contexts, in certain ways, and then, like, if I'm amongst yeshiva guys and I'm talking about Gemara, I'll say I learn, right? Which is really a Yiddish sizing of learn, which means to study, right? But if I'm talking to someone who's not in the yeshiva community, right, if you say, and I say I'm learning, they'll say, what are you learning, right? And I'll say, no, I'm sorry, I'm studying Talmud, right? Learn means to learn something new. Study, lav dafka, right? But in order for it to make sense to them, you have to code switch, right? Essentially, right? Meaning, or, right? Like, or whatever, right? Code switching is where I recognize the value of making something make sense to an outsider, right? So what she sees in the text also is that Rabbi Yochanan feels compelled in this thing to say, listen, right? For my students, I'll tell them, Gzeira himel fanai, because however, everything we just said about Gzeira, whatever that means, that obedience, or sometimes you don't need to understand because you recognize that God is rational, big adol, and if you don't understand that, whatever, that resonates with my people. But what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai clearly understands is that it's also important to be able to articulate the values to others. Now, the problem is that there's code switching that's honest and code switching that's dishonest, right? When I say to someone I'm studying Talmud, I'm not being dishonest. I'm just not using yeshivish jargon. But that's code switching where if I say learn, you know that I'm part of the learning community. But when I say study someone else, I'm not lying. It's just that they don't know the jargon, right? What's interesting here is that this is a different type of code switching. It's what I'm saying to him makes no sense. It just resonates with him, right? Right? How do I know? Because the Talmidim say, lazed dechidu b'kaneh. Right?
Know that his answer makes sense.
Right? But it makes sense to him. Now, the fact that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai thinks that it's valuable to make someone else understand the Torah, even if you don't actually fully believe what you're saying to them, that's already much more interesting because, right, the Gemara in Yoma, for example, lacks that. The Gemara in Yoma just says they're going to criticize them, and you should feel confident that it's Gzeira. And if they don't like it, too bad. Right? Right? That's one model, which is, you don't like it. Okay, fine. I don't have to answer to you. Yochanan ben Zakkai apparently thinks that there's a value to make it make sense to them, even if that's not the real reason. Now, that's an interesting claim because that's two very different perspectives on Chok. One is celebrating the fact that other people won't understand. V'azma, right? You'll be confident that you know that this is right. The other one is saying no, but, right? PR-wise, you actually have to get them to understand. Those are two very different traditions.
No,
I'm not saying Chok. I'm just saying that in this context, you actually are getting two different perspectives, right? That one is saying you're almost supposed to celebrate the fact they don't understand it. If they don't get it, too bad. The other one is saying it's true. Between me and Ezra, we can talk about it's a gzera, and we can talk about the lumdos of Chok. Is it what it understand? But when you talk to them, you can't just leave them, right? You can't leave them, and this is very important, right? Because, what? I don't know, right? I mean, I don't know, but it's important to think about this, right? That at least this source seems to believe that even when things don't make sense, there's like an importance to the PR component, right? And again, that's despite the fact that this is not the reason, right? The Gemara, the Midrash is explicit about lezed achito b'kaneh. So that's important because that's very, right? That's two very different perspectives. So this is why when you said before, what would Chazal say? These are two different voices. They're very different voices, right? So that's another point that I wanted to make here, because and I think it's worth thinking about, which is it valuable to basically sometimes, because sometimes it's valuable to be able to say, listen, I know you don't get it, but I'm committed. And people will say, you know what? I respect that. And sometimes you have to say, you know,
I'm committing.
You're committed, right? They'll respect commitment, right? Sometimes people do that. He has convictions and he lives by them, even when it's hard, even when it doesn't make sense to other people, right? And sometimes people say, no, you got to explain to me why the heck you're doing this. Like, otherwise, right? Those are two different. Okay. Another point that I want to make. I know I'm rushing a little bit now, but just because at least give you Chomer L'Machshava. Like I said, it's going to be 10 hours, and I really would keep going. But another point. The Rav makes this point. I remember I pulled this out because, you know, debate team in Rambam was like, whatever, Yaakov Miller and I were always on the same. We were like a team, and we would often just sort of make up our arguments on the bus to debate just for fun. We weren't like, it was just fun. So one time I decided I was going to use this piece by the Rav that had nothing to do with what we were talking about universal healthcare. So I decided to use the piece by the Rav on Chok and Mishpat. Why not? But why not? It was so much fun. Okay. I always had fun in debate. I can tie anything into anything if I really want. It was fun. Anyways, but the Rav makes a very interesting point. The Rav says that he asks, why does Chok exist? So we've talked about different reasons, but the Rav adds an element, and I think it's very powerful. The Rav says one of the reasons Chok exists is to anchor Mishpat. What does that mean? He says, listen, here's the problem. What's the problem with Mishpat? There's a built-in problem with Mishpat. No, that's not a problem. There's a problem with Mishpat. And that is that, so that there's a joke that one of my professors said, which I'm not sure it's a joke, but my thesis advisor said that the joke in philosophy departments, you've probably heard it from me before, is that the most immoral person in any philosophy department is the ethics professor. Why? Because they spend all day making philosophical arguments and, you know, using all their wisdom to make arguments, but they can justify anything, right? But, yes, Good Place is great. So much fun.
No way.
Yeah, we can talk about The Good Place later.
What?
Fun times. He did. It's a good book, too. It's fun. Anyways, but he says like this, listen, and you see this all the time in politics, right? Think about it. Why is murder bad? So we'll say, human life is infinitely valuable. Whether you can ground that with our religion, good question. But okay. Okay? So now you'll say that should be inviolable. And yet you'll say, well, it's not. Look at what did the Nazis do? They said, you're right, human life is inviolable. But Jews aren't humans. Boom. Right? Or you go to Canada, Lavdil, right? Look, Canada says, listen, no, why is life valuable? Life is valuable because autonomy is valuable. But really, the value isn't life. The value is living life in the way you want to live. So really, the uber value isn't life, it's autonomy. And therefore, if you don't want to live, so then you should be allowed to die. And therefore, the autonomy is so much so, then doctors shouldn't have autonomy if they don't want to kill you. And therefore, you will have an assisted suicide, physician-assisted suicide, or what they call MAID, right? Medical assisted, whatever. In death, right? In dying, whatever. And if you don't want to do it, you must give what's called effective referral. You can't just say, I won't do it. You have to send them to the doctor who will do it. Right? And people get, right? And last year, I think it was 14% of all deaths in Canada were medically assisted suicide. And they pushed off, I kid you not, they pushed off legislating the last part of it, which was to include in justifications for it mental illness, including depression, because they don't think the medical system is going to handle it for the next few years, right? And there was discussion, at least when I was in Canada, of how young they would allow people to do it. They were talking about it as young as 16 with parental. I mean, it's like, it's completely bonkers. It's completely crazy. And you'll say, right, Canada has all these crazy laws, right? It'll be like, not to pick on Canada, but to pick on Canada, right? Where Canada is like, look, right, Canada comes with these crazy things, which is, you guys, I do got to run soon because of the road. So guys, for example, another in Canada, they'll say, listen, eugenics is bad. Why is eugenics bad? Because, you know, you'll start being biased against females. You start getting that, you know, whatever, right? So if you, in Canada, if you choose the sex of your child when you're doing IVF, it carries, at least last I checked, up to a 10-year prison sentence and a 5-year, 10-year prison sentence and $500,000 fine. Sorry about that. But we respect autonomy. So we expect autonomy of women, which includes abortion, because we've decided that fetuses have no rights. And therefore, if you want to abort the child because it's the wrong sex, that's totally legal. Right? There was a doctor who said, you people are nuts, right? It's like, you respect autonomy, so you came up with this expansive laws of abortion. But you also don't want, you know, bias. You came up with these draconian laws about choosing the other child, but you never thought about when they work together. So, like, the law is completely nuts, but why each of them has a lumdus, right? The Rav said, at some level, even Mishpat, what grounds it is a little bit of chok, right? Which is that, look, we can say human life is inviolable, and that's why you shouldn't murder, but we can then start arguing, is it really human life? Is it human life lived in a certain way? Is it human life with autonomy? What you need is a shtickle chok to make sure that people don't lumdus their way out of acting ethically, right? Right? I think there's a lot there, right? Which we can't explore now if I ever want to get home tonight, right? But I think that's an important point, that chok, the recognition that again, whether you take Rashi or Rambam, right, that there's a reason that you don't understand it, or that it doesn't have a reason. But the notion that even within Mishpat, there's certain things that are grounded and you can't argue, you can't lumdus your way out of it, I think is important because it grounds morality. Yeah.
Would you want to argue that all these things will lead to the bad conclusions just come from bad ideas?
So I will be honest that here, I don't think it matters. Meaning, I take your point, right? Meaning, Ezra's point is, well, maybe it's just bad lumdus, which it might very well be bad lumdus, right? Or bad philosophy. But here's the problem. Is that if you don't, let's come back to Rasajagon. Let's say it is bad philosophy, but if you can't necessarily prove to someone else that it's bad philosophy, and you don't have any divine law, or you don't have law anchoring it, right, then you may not be able to convince them in time. Right, so I'm not committed to this in a fundamental sense. It could be, right, it could be that you would say if you had a million years, you would come to the precise conclusions of the Torah. It could be. But between now and a million years from now, you got to make sure that you don't have a society where 14% of the deaths are physicians and suicide, which is completely nuts. Right? It's completely off the wall. It makes no sense. But the svara is, no, we said human life. We didn't mean human life. We mean human life because of autonomy, a well-lived life in the way that you want it. Mimela. And like last year, there was this crazy case of a guy who had back problems, which was an illness. He was living in public housing, lost his right to public housing, and then said, I'm applying for physicians to insist that, and got it. And he said, I'm doing it, my excuse is I have a back disease and therefore a back illness, and therefore I'm allowed to apply for physicians to insist that. The real reason is because I don't have a house, right? And I would rather die than be homeless. So instead, someone waking up and saying, let's get the guy a house, they just said, well, he has an illness, and he applied for it. Boom! I'm like, are you people, what respect for human life, autonomy? Like, are you crazy? Give the guy a place to live, right? He doesn't want to die. He told you he doesn't want to die. But he has an excuse. He fits the rules technically. Oh, I have a lumdus. Right? Is it that you have to apply because of the illness? Right? Is it, or the illness has to be present? Oh, I get him a chakira. You're like, what are you out of your mind? I mean, like, you're being completely crazy, right? Okay. One more thing, and like I said, there's a million things, but I think thinking about chok is important because, again, it exists, and why, I think, right, we've talked about just a few of the elements of why this is important. But even though it's already later than I said I was going to leave, I need to leave you with one point, and this is Mamash Chomer L'Makshava. Right, Clapper has a very suggestive piece that I think is beautiful and very important, which is that you don't have to think about chok and mishpat exclusively in objective terms. Okay? Another way of thinking about chok and mishpat, there's an experiential chok and mishpat. Meaning, chok is a law that I experience as I keep it because I don't understand it. Mishpat is a law that I keep because I also identify with its meaning. L'may nafkamina. So it's very simple. The nafkamina is as follows. Mishpatim aren't just laws that we keep. They're laws that ideally inform the rest of our religious experience. Because I know why God commanded them, and therefore the values that emerge from them tell me more than this mitzvah. Coming back to Ariel's point before, right? Lifnim Meshurat Adin, right? You can go beyond the letter of the law if I understand the law, because then I can say, the law wants me to take care of other people. It only mandates me taking care of the people up to this point, but if I go farther, that makes sense, right? Chok, we don't do that. Chok, they're part of a religious life because we keep them. But no one says, oh, I live my life as a para aduma Jew. I'm like, what does it mean? I mean, like, I don't know what para aduma means. So my whole life is inspired by para aduma. I mean, like, what? It makes no sense, right? So he says experientially, when you say something is a chok, what you're saying is this is a law I keep because God said so, but it doesn't influence the rest of my life because I just don't know what it means. Right? And by saying something to mishpat, you now open it up as another data point in how you experience not just this law, but the totality of your life. So why is that important? So he argues, he says, because that means that A, there is a cost every time you call something a chok, right? Because certain mitzvot, it's not clear whether they're a chok, right? When you treat something as a chok, there's a cost. You now lost a data point in your religious life, right? If you treated all the mitzvot as chok, you would just have 613 things you do, right? And no vision of what God wants. So there's a cost to doing a chok. On the other hand, by treating something as a chok, a mitzvah that doesn't is not just you don't understand, but bothers you, you can somewhat neutralize its effect on you psychologically. Meaning, if you say, listen, I'm committed to God, but this mitzvah really bothers me, you can say, okay, I'm going to act as if this is a chok. I don't understand it, right? Maybe I can't understand it, but I'm going to keep it. So I'm going to keep it. I'm committed to God, but I'm not going, I can't understand it, right? And that's okay with me, but it now longer is a data point. Just give me 2 seconds, okay? He says, descriptively, but maybe also instructively, this is how many people deal with certain mitzvot. So for example, he has 2 examples that he likes using. He says, one is women's issues, right? Where people who fundamentally are biased, let's say, not in a bad way, I'm just using this for shorthand, towards believing that the ideal should be pure egalitarianism, right? Treat the limitations of women's in Eidot or Melech or whatever as chukim. They say, listen, when the Torah says it's usur, but in other cases, I'm not going to say women are excluded unless I know the Torah excludes them. People who say, no, the Torah says they can't be a Melech, and therefore we should be biased towards saying, passing like the Rambam, right? To expand that to Sarah. And things that are not obviously Sarah will come up with things. No, you know, take Rav Shechter, for example, that Sniut means being in private. And really, no one should be a leader because it's a violation of Sniut. But someone needs to do it. And, right? They build a whole philosophy around it, right? The other example he gives is homosexuality, right? Where certain people, the way they deal with the fact that it exists is it bothers them that the Torah forbids homosexuality. So what do? They say, listen, right? We're talking about people committed to halacha. Some people say, okay, but it's a chok. I can live with God saying it, but don't start explaining. Don't tell me why it makes sense. I don't know why it makes sense. I'm willing to accept it, but, right? You know, I'm limiting it. It's usur. Beyond that, don't tell me it points to a vision of marriage, right? The fact that I don't understand the fact that in my heart of hearts, I wish it was mutter, right? I treat it like paraduma, right? What other people say, well, that's a cop-out. Right? You're losing a data point in terms of what is marriage? What's the centrality of procreation? Right? So he argues that we should recognize that chok and mishpat aren't always objective categories. Right? The act of calling something a chok is an act to say this is something I'm willing to keep, but I don't understand and therefore I'm not going to let it influence the rest of my worldview. And mishpat is one where I say it is. And there's a cost. Right? Again, there's a cost going to a chok. There's also a cost going to mishpat if you get it wrong. Right? Right, so that's, I think, another thing to think about is the fact that chok and mishpat can also be an experiential category, right? Which, again, is not so far from, let's say, the Rambam's, because the Rambam thinks there is a reason, it's just that I don't understand it. So it might not just be experiential. That's actually what a chok is, something I don't understand. Okay, last point, then I got to drive, because I'm not going to. Yeah.
Say, after
the word,
he says, like,
English,
where he says, like, every mitzvah you come upon, even if you don't know the reason, you should try to give it a reason, which seems to be, even if this isn't, so to say, like, the...
You're probably talking more about the last halacha and Mi'ilah Chet, but...
Yeah.
Fine.
It seems to imply the opposite of what Klaber is saying, because... Rabbi Klaber is saying, because, really, like you said, that is, you know, trying to give a purpose...
So that's what he says. No. He says that, obviously, you should be biased or training the mishpat because it gives you more data points. But it is... I don't think... Put it this way, if you told the Rambam, listen, if I have to treat this as a chok, then I'm leaving Judaism because I can't live with believing that this is like the vision of Judaism, right? I don't think the Rambam says you give them reasons to make it meaningful to you, not necessarily they're the right reason. But what if someone said, but if I try to give it a reason, it's going to destroy my commitment to Judaism? I'm not sure the Rambam would say that person isn't allowed to just say, he recognizes a certain thing of our chukim, right? It's legitimate for someone to say, I don't understand, I experience it as a chok. I don't think the Rambam would necessarily say that's illegitimate. But again, this is experiential. Right? I'm not saying objectively. I'm saying that this is the reality of how some people relate. Okay, you have to take the last one. I got to drive. Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Just to clarify, it would be, if something is in reality a mishpat, which means it is teaching you like a greater vision than just
yeah.
It would be a mistake to just...
100%. No, so that's Rabbi Klaber's point. No, sorry, Klaber explicitly makes the point that you should always be biased to treat as a mishpat, that's why I don't think it's against the Rambam. He's saying, listen, the bias should always be treated as a mishpat because the bias is to think that every mitzvah is a data point in a holistic vision. But we know that certain things are chukim. So it's clear that even though our bias is towards treating something as a mishpat, chok is an option. So therefore, he thinks that experientially we should talk not just about chok and mishpat, but chokification and mishpatification, right? Which again, is something to think about. Again, I agree with you that it's not, I agree with you, and so does Rabbi Klaber in this whole article, that the bias should be towards Mishpat. That doesn't mean that it's illegitimate when someone says, right, if someone said to you, listen, I'm willing to live with the limitation on women not being Eidud as long as you tell me it's a chok. Meaning, I can't believe the Torah wants to disenfranchise women. I'm willing to say there's some Gzeira Kaduv about Eidud. I'm willing to live with that, right?
Isn't that a denial of the vision that the Torah gave us?
Only if you know that it's a Mishpat.
Right, meaning if
they said that about murder, I would say they're a terrible person. Right, if they said I'm willing to live with the prohibition of murder, but it's a mishpat, I would say you have a distorted vision. Right?
Why don't you say the same thing about it?
Because we know there are chukim. Right? I mean, we know there are chukim. We don't necessarily know which are chukim. And as the Rambam said, right? The Rambam said, as you quoted from the Rambam before, so the Rambam thinks some mitzvot, their general vision has a reason, but the pratim don't. So if someone said, Eidud makes sense, but I don't know why women, I don't know why Karov, we cut it off at first cousin, right? Or these cousins. That's not crazy, right? Meaning, the example of women Eidud really is a prat, right? If someone says it's a prat, the Rambam says that the pratim don't need to have whatever, right? I don't think it's the biggest deal. I agree with you. That, the fact that women can't be Eidud is bothers me less if someone says it's a chok, right? Than homosexuality. Because that is not a prat, right? That's a whole mitzvah. That comes to the broader question, which we're not getting to, but as I said, is the general machlok in Chazal, whether the Arayot are Chukim or Mishpatim. Remember, according to the Gemara and Yoma, this isn't even controversial. The Gemara and Yoma says that Arayot are Chukim. No, sorry. The Gemara and Yoma says they're Mishpatim. In others, in the Sifra, I think. Yeah, no, the Sifra says that Arayot are Chukim. So, Davka by Arayot, it's a much broader question, right? Which is, are the Arayot in general Chukim or Mishpatim? But I agree with you. The bias should be towards Mishpat. That doesn't mean that experientially, it's not legitimate for some people to say, I can only remake it, especially in Pratim. I mean, women's psalm Eidah, that's an easy case, right? You have to find that to be a mishpat. Why? Right? Even with the Rambam, it's a detail within Eidah. Okay, I got to run.